And I think that becomes important in understanding the way he deals with the issue of patronage. For Jefferson, particularly in his years in opposition, patronage was the very essence of corruption. And in his inaugural, Jefferson had called for an end to partisan hostility. He'd called for reconciliation and, in fact, bipartisanship. Let us then, fellow citizens, unite with one heart and one mind. Let us restore to social intercourse that harmony and affection without which liberty and even life itself are but dreary things. And let us reflect that having banished from our land that religious intolerance under which mankind so long bled and suffered, we have yet gained little if we countenance a political intolerance as despotic, as wicked, and capable of as bitter and bloody persecutions. So again, he's returning to this call for pluralism. But every difference of opinion is not a difference of principle. We have called by different names brethren of the same principle. We are all Republicans. We are all Federalists. This is an incredibly stirring piece of rhetoric. And I don't think it's just rhetoric. Jefferson had always had misgivings about partisanship and party. To Francis Hopkinson in 1789, he wrote, "If I could not go to heaven but with a party, I would not go there at all." But in practice, Jefferson turns out to be extremely partisan. Military historians have argued that, in fact, he uses West Point to create a Republican officer corps so that he can cashier the Federalist generals. He purges the judiciary as much as possible of Federalist appointments. In March of 1801, he decides that he's going to remove all executive appointments after the previous date of December 18th. And the reason is because that was when he felt the election results were clear. And after that point, he felt that Adams had no right to appoint any judges. We call them midnight judges. And this was achieved, in fact, by repealing the Judiciary Act of 1801, which had created circuit court judges and circuit courts so that the Supreme Court didn't have to travel great distances. And in fact, that's one of the programs he lays out in his first annual message. The judiciary system of the United States, and especially that portion of it recently erected, will of course present itself to the contemplation of Congress, and that they may be able to judge of the proportion which the institution bears to the business it has to perform. And in fact, the act is repealed and all of those judges are cashiered. But he goes further than that. He, in fact, impeaches several Federalist judges, and some of the grounds of the impeachment are troubling given his own principles. Take the case of John Pickering, a Federalist judge impeached in February of 1803. Now, I think there are reasonable grounds for removing him from office. He's allegedly, or at least claimed to be, insane. But for a strict constructionist, the Constitution states you can only impeach for high crimes and misdemeanors, and insanity is neither. And in fact, he's impeached for misbehavior, an extra-constitutional doctrine. Well, if that can be justified by the problem of having a purported madman on the bench, that same cannot be said for the impeachment of Justice Samuel Chase, another Federalist, who had been guilty, in Jefferson's eyes, of perfidy when he harangued a grand jury about the dangers of mobocracy on February 2, 1803. When Jefferson learns of this tirade, he writes to one of his congressional supporters, "Ought this seditious and official attack go unpunished?" On March 12th, the House indicts Samuel Chase. There is no high crime. There is no misdemeanor. There is no significant charge. His removal is entirely partisan, neither misbehavior or criminality. And his appointments and removals are often strictly partisan, something which causes no small amount of complaint. For example, he removes most of the customs officers appointed by the Federalists. And when complained about this, particularly the case of a Mr. Goodrich of Connecticut, he informs the complainers, "Declarations by myself in favor of political tolerance, exhortations to harmony and affection in social intercourse, and to respect for the equal rights of the minority," clearly referring to his inaugural address, "have on certain occasions been quoted and misconstrued into assurances that the tenure of offices was to be undisturbed. When it is considered that during the late administration those who are not of a particular sect of politics were excluded from all office, when by a steady pursuit of this measure nearly the whole offices of the U.S. were monopolized by that sect, when the public sentiment at length declared itself and burst open the doors of honor and confidence to those whose opinions they more approved, was it to be imagined that this monopoly of office was still to be continued in the hands of the minority?